The key concepts of conformal field theory and of some of the range of applications that it can have. And today we're going to start with a systematic study of conformal field theories and the constraints that conformal symmetry imposes on correlation functions. So the ultimate goal is to learn how to compute the observables of conformal field theories. Okay? So what are the observables? These are the correlation functions of operators in the CFT. So the kind of object that we're interested in some correlation function of the product of a bunch of operators, like that. And in fact, in CFT, there's a rich zoo of types of operators that one can consider, and some of them have different applications for different types of physics, but you can roughly, and we will try to study several types of them. But broadly speaking, they can be characterized according to in which subspace of your spacetime the operator is supported. So the operators that you're most familiar with are local operators. Where the operator is supported at a point in X time, in spacetime. But in conformal field theories, there are also interesting types of operators which are non-local. Which instead of being supported at a point in spacetime, so here the idea you should have is if you want to compute, say, the four-point function of four local operators, I have to specify the four points in my spacetime where the operators are supported. So here we have one, or two, or three, or four. But you can also have non-local operators that are supported on some submanifold sigma. That need not be a point. It can be a higher dimensional submanifold. So an example of that would be, for example, if you have, well, this thing is supposed to represent the space-time where the theory lives. And you could consider a situation where you look at the correlation function of one local operator with the correlation function of an operator that's supported on a loop. So this would be, this would be a local operator, and this would be an operator O of C, where C is this curve. Okay? And it's called a loop operator. And these are also interesting observables in conformal field theory. In actual physical systems, another thing that is interesting to do, that hopefully we'll get to also, is that you can have systems where where the theory has a boundary. And that's typically what happens when you have, in a condensed matter system, you know, the sample ends somewhere. And many times there's lots of interesting physics happening at the boundary. So one of the things that we will study is kind of the effect of boundaries in a conformal field theory. So this is kind of a preview of what are the things that we're going to aim to study. But before doing this fun stuff, we have to discuss a bit better, more systematically. Even though I already kind of gave a definition of what a conformal transformation is, I want to completely characterize the general set of conformal transformations in flat spacetime. So what we're going to do in this lecture is to determine the set of all conformal transformations. In flat spacetime. And by flat spacetime, you will see that will not make a big difference one way or the other. It can either be a Minkowski. Or Euclidean. And by that I mean a space that has So I'll always be using the flat space metric by eta, and eta can either be minus, plus, as many plus. So if we're in these space-time dimensions, the Minkowski metric has one negative eigenvalue and d minus one positive eigenvalue. So this would be for Minkowski. And for Euclidean, just the diagonal metric with plus ones in the diagonal. One of the things that, one reason to do this, of course, that even though you have now, by now, hopefully, an intuition of what a dilatation transformation is, we should also develop some intuition about a not very intuitive transformation that the conformal group has. But more importantly for us, later on, will be that once we determine the set of transformations, of conformal transformations, you should remember from your field theory class that if a quantum field theory has a global symmetry, global continuous symmetry, like a Poincaré symmetry, which is associated with a particular transformation, like a Poincaré transformation, then by Noether's theorem, it implies that associated to every global continuous transformation, there is a conserved current, J mu. And the statement that it is conserved is just a statement that the derivative of the current vanishes. Okay. And from this conserved current, we associate conserved charges by essentially integrating some Q. So Q stands for charge, where you essentially integrate the zeroth component. So this is a d vector, so it has d component. And you integrate the time component of the vector over the spatial directions. And this is a conserved charge. And these are very useful in constraining the form that the correlators can have. And what we will see is that by doing the exercise that we will do now, which is to determine the set of coordinate transformations that give rise to conformal transformations, once we have that data, we will immediately get the conserved currents associated to conformal symmetry, which, as we will see, can be written unambiguously in terms of the stress energy tensor of the field theory that you're studying and the vector fields associated to conformal transformations, which I will now discuss. Any questions about where we're going? Okay, so now we have to do some little bit of gymnastics. So it is useful to study the conformal symmetry in arbitrary d space-time dimensions, because we'll see that different things happen in different dimensions. So let's dv the dimension of space-time. And I want to study conformal transformations in d-dimensional flat space-time, okay? So what I want to study is conformal transformations. Remember from my definition, are coordinate transformations. Well, physically, the way to define it is that these are coordinate transformations that preserve angles. But in formulas, what this means are coordinate transformations that map x mu to some other coordinate x tilde mu, which is a function of x, which have the property. So, which has the property that the metric, so if you started with a, so it might be useful here to think a bit more generally to connect, hopefully, with things that, well, that you have definitely seen in the GR course. So for this discussion, it might be useful to not only think of flat spacetime, but to think of studying field theory in an arbitrary curved spacetime that has so now we are in a arbitrary spacetime metric. Gimuno. By the way, the question of what are the conformal symmetries is a question that you can ask given any background spacetime metric. There's a well-defined notion of conformal transformations for any, even for curved metrics. But the reason I want to write it this way is that hopefully you will recognize these formulas. So you know that if I make a coordinate transformation, the metric transforms. So the metric transforms. So you start with your metric, you get a new metric, which is related to the original one judged by some metric like that. And a conformal transformation, so an arbitrary coordinate transformation will map x into x tilde and g into g tilde. And a conformal transformation, well, before I talk about conformal transformation, let's talk about something that you're more familiar with. Let's talk about a subset of conformal transformations that you've already been using, which are the, okay. So if you were in flat spacetime, you would call them Poincaré transformations. In flat spacetime. If you are in a curved spacetime, like here, right now I'm using just a curved metric, this would be called the isometry transformation. Okay? Which have the property, they're defined by the coordinate transformation such that the original metric is exactly the same as the transformed metric. And therefore, the same as this. Okay? This is defined as the set of transformations that generate. So, transformations X that have this property generate. So, of this property generate. Isometries. They preserve, iso means same, and metrics means they preserve the metrics. So just to do, just to maybe connect this with what you know from Minkowski space, we can try to solve that equation in Minkowski space. Yes?
On top. On top of? Like you said, g mu tilde x tilde is
no.
X rho x tilde.
The indices have to marry appropriately. So, zero sigma on the right hand side, lower index. So, it has to connect with the same type of coordinate. So, that's why. So, g mu. The tildes are downstairs, so that's why x tilde appears downstairs. And x appears upstairs because it contracts with the, until the g, which is. Yes, so that's how a tensor would transform. So it matters a lot whether a tensor is covariant or contravariant, that's the way of saying it. But in pedestrian language, it's just that whether the tensor has lower or upper indices. And in fact, maybe I will give an exercise to see how to distinguish, for example, how a vector, this was part of the homework yesterday, how a vector with one lower index transforms compared to a vector with an upper index. They transform differently, precisely because you have to put the tildes in the right place. Any other question? So let's try to solve this simple equation in flat space-time. So once we The reason I'm doing isometries first is because it's something that you know, and then we'll move to conformal transformation, and you'll see that actually it's just a small generalization of the idea of isometry. So the equation that we have to solve to determine the isometries of flat spacetime is I take my Minkowski metric, and I want to solve this like that. And now let's consider, for simplicity, just an infinitesimal coordinate transformation. So this is a transformation in the Kapuscin in some sense is connected to the identity. So a transformation that doesn't do very much, which in formulas means that I take x mu, which is the transformed coordinate to be the original coordinate, plus something that we think of it as small. B mu, which is as a function of x. Okay? Then this equation, and you'll have to help me to make sure I don't mess it up, but roughly the idea is that let's expand this equation. And since we're doing a small transformation, we will keep the right-hand side. So here I have to take all kinds of derivatives, but we'll only keep derivatives, sorry, terms, which are first order in the infinitesimal transformation. So here I have this transformation, but here I have to take the derivative of x with respect to x tilde, but to leading order, I can invert this coordinate transformation trivially to leading order by saying that just so that it's easy to do this derivative. Okay, so now I can take derivatives. So the derivatives here, I wanted a mu. So if I take derivatives here, what you get is a term which is delta rho mu minus the derivative of mu b rho times delta sigma nu minus d nu b sigma times eta rho sigma. Okay? I'm doing a complete triviality. I'm just taking some derivative here, okay? And now I have to equate the left-hand side with the right-hand side. So the terms that are of order b to the zero, so there has no b's, I have this delta, 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 so I just get eta mu nu. So this will cancel with this. And then I get to leading order in this, I get this guy times this guy times this guy. So it's d mu b nu. And now the other way around, I have this guy times this guy times this guy, which is minus d mu b mu. And since the left-hand side has to be the same as the right-hand side, the isometries of the infinitesimal coordinate transformations that generate an isometry in Minkowski space are the ones generated by b's that solve this equation. And this has a name. Well, okay. We could have done exactly the same exercise in curved spacetime, and we'll come back to that. But in fact, if I did this in curved spacetime, so instead of choosing here the Minkowski metric, I had kept an arbitrary curved space metric. The equation changes a little bit, but it's fixed essentially by covariance, general covariance. And the equation that you would get if I have a curved metric. So what is the covariant object in general relativity? The derivative is not very covariant, so is there some object that would Okay. So maybe you can remind me how... Okay, so this is... this equation, so let me just finish this and then I'll ask you something. So, and this type of equation that determines the symmetries or isometries of a given metric is called the Killing. I think Killing, the guy was called Killing, but it's a weird name, but it's called the Killing equation. And these B mu's that satisfy this equation, it's called they call killing vectors. And these play an important role in, well, everywhere, but in particular general relativity. And they're closely related to conserved quantities in field theory and GR. So just that we're all in the same page, I mean, can someone tell me what the covariant derivative, the curved covariant derivative of a of this thing is? Okay, so I'll write, and you, so now what do I do? Plus or minus?
Minus.
That's why, yeah, okay. But of course, in flat spacetime, the metric is flat, and the Christoffel symbols vanish. So that's why in flat spacetime, we just get the simple equation. And now we can very easily solve this equation for flat spacetime, and then we recover the things that you know a lot, which are the Poincaré transformation. Because essentially, you can solve that equation is solved by a vector b mu, which is a constant, is an arbitrary constant a mu, plus something that you can write like this. So this is some constant, and this is also a constant, but with the property that follows from just plug this thing here. And you will immediately see that this parameter omega mu nu has to be antisymmetric. Okay? And the way you should think about this is that you know exactly what this thing is. If I look at the coordinate transformation, when I put the infinitesimal parameter w to 0, so for a mu, what you get is that x mu goes to x mu plus a mu, right? Remember that b mu parameterized the shift away from x, but this is nothing but a translation. And if I look at the transformation generated by omega mu nu, what I get is a Lorentz transformation, infinitesimal Lorentz transformation, because I get x goes to x plus omega mu nu x nu, which is a Lorentz transformation. So these are which generate the Poincaré transformations. Okay? And notice that here, and we'll see the difference between this and conformal transformation, this vector field that generates the coordinate infinitesimal coordinate transformation is at most linear in the coordinate. So there is has a term which has no x dependent, and then a term that's linear in x. Okay, that's it. Because and you can see this immediately by just solving this equation. Okay. Any questions about this? This should be a bit of a review of things that you hopefully have seen. So now we're ready to. Now that I've motivated and connected Poincaré transformations to spatial transformations, perhaps in a way that you have not completely seen. Now what I want to do is go back to the notion of a conformal transformation. So let me start with a new blackboard. So let's go back here. So here, the name of the game is that we make a coordinate transformation. We know how a metric transforms under a coordinate transformation. Now, for a conformal transformation, which is defined physically as a transformation that preserves angles, but not distances. What we require is that the conformal transformation just rescales the metric. Okay, so let me write it again, just to be very pedantic. So, and let's look now for simplicity at infinitesimal transformation. Such that the transformed metric that you compute in the standard way from just general coordinate invariance equals the original metric. So if I state like this, this would be an isometry, that we just discussed. But a conformal transformation is something more general that allows the metrics to be related up to an overall scale, which is in fact a function of X in general. So this defines the coordinate transformations that give rise to conformal transformations. It's essentially a rescaling of the metric by this, this thing is called the conformal factor. Is it clear what the definition is? It's a slight change of the notion of an isometry. Notice that, of course, by doing this, since I'm rescaling the overall size of the metric, conformal transformations do not preserve distances because I have rescaled my metric by some factor. So the distance between these two points can change. But there are theories that, like all the things I've been talking about the last 2 days, that have the physical property, remarkable property, that they look the same at all length scales. Yes. Well, it's not very physical to have. Imagine we're in odd dimension. Imagine you're in odd dimension. The determinant would be negative. That's a good question. More questions?
OK. So now we will proceed to solving this equation in a flat space. And I essentially done the hard work, which is just this. So now all I have to do is do this equation, but now I allow myself to put here an omega square. Okay.
So I'm not going to write all of this again. If that, well, hopefully it's completely transparent. But if not, you can ask me, of course. So let me see in what order I want to say things. Yeah. So here, okay, I'm doing flat space first. So here, essentially the equation that you will get so is this. But now, instead of this equals 0, the right-hand side has an overall scale that under a small transformation is 1 plus a small thing. So omega under an infinitesimal transformation what I have is that I can write always omega of x, the conformal factor, as 1 minus little omega x. Okay? So then, just exactly like I did there, rewriting this equation will give me an equation which is, in flat space, is proportional. It's not 0 anymore. It's proportional to the original metric. Yes.
Is the
determinant
of eta always negative, no matter
what
time?
The
determinant.
Oh, okay. Well, I think the point is that you want to make a transformation that will not change the signature of the space time. So if you start in a given signature, it seems reasonable that you're preserving this new signature. But it's true that indeed, I mean, in quantity space time, you have one negative eigenvalue. So what we take is we take the magnitude of the determinant. But if omega square was negative, it would change the signature. I think that's really the
reverse.
So now we have a transformation that is not zero but proportional to the metric, and we can determine what the factor is just by taking the trace of this equation. So this f of x, which is of course related to this omega x. But the point is now by taking the trace, what you find is that f of x is, what you get is that twice the derivative of b equals d times f of x, so that f of x is two over d, the derivative of b. So that the conformal transformation is a solution of this equation. And this equation, so this equation had a name, which was the Killing equation. This is called the conformal Killing equation. And B mu, instead of being a Killing vector, is called a conformal Killing vector. Which again, finding out that explicit form is crucial in writing down the conserved currents of the theory. Okay?
Hey, what's f of x?
Well, f of x is related to this omega, so we can calculate what it is. But I was just determining it by saying that consistency of the fact that in this equation I can take the trace, so I can multiply this equation by eta mu, will tell you what f of x is. But f of x is essentially this omega. Any more questions? And now, okay, so this was in flat space-time. If you do the same exercise in curved space-time, you essentially have to covariantize this equation. So what you get is the covariant derivative instead of the derivative. And instead of eta mu here, you get the curved metric. So this would be in curved space-time. So given a metric, you can, by solving these equations, you can determine all conformal transformation. There could be manifolds that have no conformal transformation. Just like there can be metrics that have no isometries. But in fact, flat spacetime, which is the main thing that we care about in this course, has the property that it has non-trivial solutions, not only to the Killing vector equation, which give us the things that we already know, which were the Poincaré transformation, but it has a very rich set of solutions of this equation. And in fact, it has as many solutions as any metric can have. So flat spacetime is, in some sense, the Minkowski metric is the metric that admits the maximal number of solutions of this equation. So it's like, in some sense, the most symmetric. Okay, so now let's. What happened? So now we're gonna again do some gymnastics and solve this equation. Well, some solutions we already know without having to do any work, because we already know that Poincaré transformations have the property that this omega equals 1, so this little omega equals 0, so that it will be a solution of this equation when this guy is 0, essentially. Yes?
Symbol, like, well, what is that, del V? Or
this?
No, right above the boxed equation on the far right board.
This?
No, that you have 2 del v equals d f of x.
Sorry, this?
No, I mean the divergence of v.
Oh, okay, that's...
That's, okay, so yeah, so this is, not to write all the inglorious, but this is this. Yeah, good question. Okay, so now let's, starting with this equation, we'll massage it a little bit.
to find the most general solution of this equation in flat space-time, in D dimensions. So the first thing I'll do, so let me write it again. I'll try to... So now the first thing I'll do is take the new derivative of this equation. So this gives us, so how I want to write this? Okay, so let me do two more steps. So here what I get is d mu of delta dot b plus d nu is the Lambertian or the Laplacian, depending if you're on Lorentzian or Euclidean signature. And here I just get yes. And now all I do is this guy is has exactly the same form as this guy, so I just bring it to the other side. So I have the Lambertian or Laplacian plus d minus 2 over d of d mu delta v equals 0. Okay? This is an immediate consequence of this equation. Now, if I act again now with now d mu, what you end up getting is, notice that if I take now the mu derivative, I get the Laplacian of the del dot b. And here I get again the Laplacian times del dot b. So this guy is proportional to this. Okay? So the derivative of the conformal Killing vector is annihilated by the Lambertian. Okay? So now, before solving it in general dimension, let me just make a couple of very quick comments that are of key importance in two dimensions. So notice that two dimensions is very, very special. And now let's see quickly why. Starting probably next week, we will essentially concentrate in two dimensions because we will be able to use the symmetries of the solutions of this equation to understand very thoroughly what these theories are. But for the time being, let's just notice that in two dimensions, let's first look at this equation. So if d equals 2, this guy cancels, right? And the conformal Killing vector equation can be written as this. Do you recognize what these equations are? Okay, good. Yeah, so these are the... So maybe in a language, just to connect it, to say it in a language that makes more clear what's going on. In two dimensions, you can introduce local complex coordinates. So have coordinates x1. Okay, so now it's convenient to think that we're in a Euclidean space. Easier to formulate. So now let's take in d equals 2 complex coordinates. Z equals x1 plus ix2. And define a complex vector field, v, which is v1 plus iv2. Then these equations are completely equivalent to the statement that the z bar derivative of the vector field vanishes. Okay? So that's the statement that in two dimensions, conformal transformation are equivalent to holomorphic transformation. Which are defined exactly by objects that are annihilated by the z-bar derivative. Okay? And of course, in two dimensions, the set of holomorphic transformations is infinite dimensional. So that's why in two dimensions, conformal symmetry is very constraining, because in fact, the set of solutions of these equations is infinite dimensional. So from here, we get that in D equals 2, the conformal symmetry is infinite dimensional. And we will study the symmetry algebra in two dimensions much more carefully. But one of the big heroes in the course will be this has a name, the conformal symmetry in two dimensions has a name, it's called the Virasoro algebra. Okay? So we see in two dimensions that this immediately tells us that the Cauchy-Riemann equation, that this is a Cauchy-Riemann equation. And we also see immediately that in two dimensions, this guy drops out, right? And what you find is that both B1 and B2 are harmonic. So this equation implies a harmonic, which means that there are solutions of the Laplacian equals zero equation, which is actually one of the known relations. I mean, a holomorphic function can be split into real and imaginary part. And both the real and imaginary part are harmonic. Okay. That's something that you've seen in your complex analysis course. So that's everything I want to say right for the time being regarding two dimensions. Now let's go back to higher dimensions. Now let's see. So now I want to do. Okay, so it follows from this set of equations that this is also true. And now, using this equation for D different from 2 implies that D rho, D sigma. I'm doing some algebra, I mean, some simple algebra in the blackboard. It's probably good that you try to do it by yourself. I mean, it's completely straightforward. I mean, but so that's another equation that we want to find. And now to completely determine what kind of behavior the conformal vector B mu can have, what we do now is take, we differentiate this equation, what is 13? We differentiate this equation twice with respect to rho sigma, okay? And use the fact that this is true. So if I differentiate this equation with respect to rho and sigma, the right-hand side drops out because that's something that we already knew. And then all I have to do is take derivatives here. So what you get is d mu, d rho, d sigma, b nu, plus d nu, d rho, d sigma, b mu equals 0. And now what I do is just write two identical equations where I permute the indices in some particular way. So another equation I can trivially get from this one is by doing the following permutation on indices, sigma mu nu. This language means that I just replace sigma by mu, mu by nu, and nu by sigma. So here I get d nu, here I wanted to differentiate. Oh, that's fine, yes. So rho I don't touch. And sigma I send to mu. And nu I send to sigma. And here nu I send to sigma. Rho I don't touch. And sigma I send to mu. And mu I send to nu. That's another equation. And the last one, so have this, this, and this. And I can get the last one from this one by yet another permutation. Sorry, making a mess here. Maybe write it here. And this last equation I can get by permuting in this way. I can send sigma to nu, nu to mu, and mu to sigma. So what I get is d sigma, d rho, d nu, d mu, plus d mu, d rho, d nu, d sigma equals 0. Okay? And now what I can do is I can sum, add up these two equations and subtract this one, noticing that this guy and this guy are the same because the derivative is commute, right? So I have here mu rho sigma, but here I have sigma rho mu, but it's the same thing. And by adding these two equations and subtracting the other two, I notice that this guy is sum, but this guy is subtract because I can kill this guy with this guy, and I can kill this guy with this guy. So this implies that the killing vector b nu is at most quadratic in the axis because it tells us that d mu, d rho, d sigma, b mu equals 0. Okay? Which implies precisely that b mu as a function of x's can be at most quadratic in the x's. So we can now just write down the most general solution of b mu in some useful parametrization. So now let's parametrize So I can parameterize b mu, and I'll, of course, for the first two terms, I'll use the same parametrization that we already had for Poincaré transformation. So there is a term which is constant. There is a term which is linear. Actually, there are two terms that are linear. One which is generated by an object with two indices.
On the chalkboard that's high up there now, you had like partial rho, partial sigma of the divergence vanishing.
Yeah.
And all you've done is, for me, like, I don't see the difference between that result and the one you just wrote down.
No, notice here that no two indices are contracted.
Sure, but above.
Yes, okay. This was used just to say that if I take this equation and I differentiate with respect to rho sigma, the right hand side vanishes.
But isn't that the conclusion we just reached?
No.
Yeah, and we just wrote the union.
No, but here you're summing over lambda. And here the whole point is that I'm not summing over lambda.
We're summing over mu's. And if you go back to...
Sorry?
Are we summing over mu's?
Oh, sorry, but this is a typo, right?
Oh, okay.
Sorry. Yeah, so... I mean, this is actually the equation that the object that has an underline equals 0.
Okay, that's
yeah, okay.
I just didn't realize that you went through a lot of work to find
it. Okay, yeah.
Sorry, this is a bit of an old question, but how did you get that bottom equation?
Sorry?
How did you get that bottom equation of the Cauchy Riemann equation?
This? Yeah. Oh, put b equals 2 here. And put mu nu equals 1 and 2. You get that. No, I mean, no mystery. Is that clear? Okay. Any more questions? Yes.
For d difference 2, right?
Yes. For d equals 2,
Well, where they said, okay, so let me finish writing this and I'll tell you qualitatively for now what the difference is. Well, first of all, the number of solutions in DB Curtain 2 is finite dimensional because I can have at most a polynomial of degree 2, which has a finite number of coefficients. So at linear order, I can have an object with two indices, which is a constant and antisymmetric. We're already familiar with this. This is the guy that generates Lorentz transformations. But I can also have a term which is constant. So these are the ones that are intuitive. These were Poincaré, translations, Lorentz transformations, dilatations, or scale transformations. Because notice that x plus b, if I make a transformation where only lambda is non-zero, essentially sends x mu to x mu plus 1 plus lambda, right? So it just rescales the coordinate by some uniform constant factor. So that was our theory in the last lecture. Another is the weird one, which is quadratic, and that's why it's not intuitive. Usually we have some intuition when we have a linear transformation on coordinates. Now we have a transformation that's non-linear. And you can parameterize this way, so x squared d mu minus 2x mu x lambda d lambda. So this is the most general infinitesimal conformal transformation in flat spacetime. And now we have identified, well, I haven't told you what this thing is called, but we have essentially now parametrized we have identified a set of basic transformations with labels A, omega, lambda, and B that describe the most general conformal transformation. So I already said that A mu, you already know what it is, it's translations. Omega mu nu is Lorentz transformations. Lambda is a scale transformation. That sometimes is called also a dilatation. The dilatation. And the weird one is called a special conformal transformation. But we will see that even though it looks very weird, maybe in one of the exercises I'll ask you to show that in fact you can construct the weird guy from things that are much more simple. So you will have an intuition about what it is. So now so this was in D different from 2. In D equals 2, things are very different. Because essentially I said that any psi, what is it? Somewhere? Any B that was holomorphic is a solution of conformal transformation. So in particular, I can parameterize an infinitesimal conformal transformation. Essentially, can write it like that for any n, for any integer, okay? Because obviously z to the n is annihilated by del bar, and n can be any integer. So the point is that unlike in two dimensions, you can have an arbitrary power of z, okay? That's the big difference in two dimensions. And we will use that. I mean, that's why we can do lots of things in two dimensions that we cannot do in higher. Okay, so now we have completely understood what is the most general conformal transformation in flat space. And now that we have this, we can immediately now use this information to write down the, in a conformal field theory, what is the form? Yes.
Well, you wrote down there in the last term, why do you have a B, for instance? Why don't you have another vector?
another vector.
Why? So you, in this last term you have v of alpha, right? In the previous term you have v of mu. Why didn't you write say c in the last term?
Well, okay. So something that one has to do, which is not hard. This argument shows that I have to write the most general quadratic equation, and now to determine what is the tensor structure of each of its term at each order, like to linear and quadratic, you have to plug this back into this, and it tells you what is the index structure of the quadratic term. So from this alone, I cannot conclude that I have to go back and plug it in here and see that I can decompose my quadratic transformation exactly. This was just.
So omega mu is still anti-symmetric?
Yes.
And is there some property that B has to obey?
No, B is an arbitrary real number, just like A.
Okay, so now we have identified in a way that what are the generators of conformal transformation. So we're ready. Let me erase this. And let's give them names. Well, I already gave them names, but let's give them formulas. So we can associate a conserved charge to each set transformation. For translations, you know what is the charge associated to translation. It's the momentum operator, P mu. For Lorentz transformations, is the Lorentz generator, M mu nu. For dilatation, we call the letter capital D, not to be confused with the space-time dimension, but maybe I should put a D hat, but I'll probably forget. But should be clear from the context whether I'm talking about the operator or the dimensionality. And the special conformal transformation, we'll call that K mu, okay? And one of the things that we will do when a theory is invariant, so far we're just doing kinematics. I just defined for you what the conformal symmetry transformations are. But now if we have a physical system that's invariant under such transformations, like the exercise tomorrow where you hopefully show that Maxwell's equations are conformal invariant, using Noether's theorem, you can now write down the associated conserved currents. Okay? And so now that we have this killing, this B mu's, which are the conformal killing vector fields, let's write down very generically. And we don't know the point is that we can write down the conserved currents associated to conformal transformations just from the one of the basic operators in field theory, which is the stress energy tensor. So let's see how that happens. Associated to all these guys. So an object that's central in the business of conformal field theory is something that you've already seen, which is the stress tensor, stress or stress energy tensor. Team, you know, is an object with two indices. And physically, what this object does is measures the response of your system and when you make a change of metric. So when you make a small perturbation of your metric, and Tmu nu is kind of a measure of how the system reacts to that change of metric. In formulas, it says that if I make a local change of metric, like a conformal transformation does, the variation of the action of your system. So imagine now, it might be useful here to connect maybe with your GR course to think for a moment that we're in an arbitrary space and background. So if I make an arbitrary metric variation, the variation of the action is given by T mu nu times the variation of the metric. So another way of saying it, that maybe that's the way you've seen it, is that T mu nu, the stress energy tensor of your theory, is obtained by taking the variation of the action with respect to the metric. Okay? And essentially all space-time transformations, all the space-time currents associated to space-time transformations can always be written in terms of this guy, because this guy is the one that knows whenever you deform your space-time a little bit. Because it knows the response of the system to a variation of the metric, which is what you get when you make a coordinate transformation. So now that we have this BNews, like, we can easily write down what are the associated conserved currents. So the way you construct it is, remember that I said that the conserved current is a vector, J mu. But the thing that's nice is that for a space-time transformations, like these are space-time transformations, you can write the conserved current as, in terms of the stress tensor, you take T mu nu, and you contract it with precisely this vector field, the corresponding vector field, okay? So times B nu. So you wish this is a current, it is a function of the transformation you were looking at. So if you were looking at, just to make this formula maybe a little bit more apparent, if I look at a translation where B nu is A nu, right? Then if you wish, the momentum generator can be written as T mu nu A nu, okay? But more generally, given any vector field, which is a symmetry, like a disconformal Killing vectors, all you have to do is to contract the stress tensor with the vector field. And now we can see what consequences the fact that the theory is conformal invariant has for the stress tensor. So let's take the derivative of the current. So I have, so there are two terms, one derivative acting on the stress tensor, and one term when the derivative acts on the vector field. Okay, so now let's go back to this. So these are all the various transformations that we have. Let's consider first what happens when B mu is an isometry. So in the flat space case means a Poincaré transformation. So one of these transformations where only A and omega are non-zero. So now something that we have to remember is that the stress energy tensor, since it's obtained from the metric by this.
That's this.
It's missing.
You got a free index nu on the right hand side of something. The first term on the right hand side.
Oh, yeah, sorry. Yes, thank you. Okay. That's the limit, right? Yeah? Okay, thank you. So now what I was saying is that since the stress tensor is the derivative of the metric. Yeah. It's a V. Sorry. Yes. So the stress tensor is symmetric. Because because it's obtained by differentiating over varying with respect to the metric, which is symmetric. So that means that actually I can write this term here as, so obviously I can take d mu b nu and write it as a symmetrization plus anti-symmetrization. I just mean that I can write this as, okay, I think you know what that means. So obviously the anti-symmetric part of d mu b nu does not contribute because d mu nu is symmetric. Is that the argument? Okay, that's clear. Good. So I can write this as okay? I haven't done anything. I just use the fact that the stress tensor is symmetric in these indices. But now you have to remember that Poincaré transformation is precisely the type of transformation for which this guy is zero. This was the killing vector equation. So that means that for a Poincaré transformation, what we have is that since this guy is zero, and this has to be zero for this to be a conserved current, what we find is that the derivative of t mu nu equals zero. So just that the gradient of the stress tensor vanishes. That's something that you already knew. But now if we let b mu be a kind of true conformal transformation, so one of these two guys. We've already established that the stress tensor is divergence free. So the only term that we have to worry about is this term. So I can write this as t mu nu times 1/2 d mu v nu plus d nu v mu. And now I can use this equation here. So I can replace this term by its right hand side. That's the definition of the conformal killing vector. So it's essentially proportional. D mu v nu is essentially proportional to the metric. And so that means that I have the t mu nu is proportional times eta mu nu, the flat space metric, which is just the statement. So this guy just means that it's the trace of the stress tensor. So you can write it like t mu, and this has to vanish. Because if this is a conserved current, the gradient of the current has to vanish. So from this we learn that a theory that is invariant under conformal transformation has a stress tensor, which is traceless. So conformal symmetry implies that t mu nu, the stress tensor of the theory, is traceless. So now that I've told you this, one way you could have done your exercise yesterday was to take electromagnetism, compute the stress tensor by, well, in the usual way, by, say, coupling the theory to some curved background, computing the stress tensor by this derivative, and demonstrating explicitly that the trace vanishes. That would have told you, without having to vary the action and all kinds of things, that the action is conformal invariant. Any questions about this? So that the stress tensor will be playing a crucial role in everything we do from now on, because it's the object in the theory that knows about space-time. Questions? And in the exercises, I will try to give you exercises that will help you develop intuition. You don't need intuition about these three guys, hopefully, but that will help you to develop some intuition about this weirder, nonlinear transformation. Okay, very good. So if there are no more questions, now what we want to do is to characterize more concretely. So this was the set of all coordinate transformations, but whenever you have a symmetry in physics, as the set of transformations that are a symmetry form the structure of a group, because if I have if one transformation is a symmetry and another one is a symmetry, if I put one after the other, it's also a symmetry. If I make a transformation, I can always undo the transformation, and this is exactly the notion of a group. And what we want to do now is understand the group structure of these conformal transformations. See what kind of relations they satisfy. Because this will be important for us later when we study how fields and operators in conformal field theories transform under conformal transformations. Yes.
But the
no, but the whole theory is not scale invariant. So you've put matter that has broken a conformal symmetry. So radiation, for example, would not do that. Okay, so as I said, if you have a set of transformations which are a symmetry, you can combine them together to get a new symmetry. So concretely, what I want to do is we want to now study what is the symmetry algebra associated to conformal transformations. So what we do is we take two different conformal transformations, one parameterized by a vector field B1, and by B1, I mean one where I have parameters A1, omega1, da-da-da, okay? And another different transformation with parameters, a different set of parameters, A2, omega2, and so on. Notice that, so the point is now if I make two different conformal transformations, I will get to this. The first term?
Yes.
Well, the first term we already knew that was. Yes, but the point is we're looking at theories that are super conformal invariant. Sorry, conformal invariant, so they're also Poincaré invariant. So in this case, we're looking at theories that are Poincaré invariant, and on top they can have extra things. So Poincaré transformations. A smaller subset of the transformation have already established that it was transverse. That a smaller subset of the transformation, which are the Poincaré transformations, that the theory already had, already told us that the Team Unu was transverse, namely that the divergence of Team Unu vanished. Yeah, because by our definition, conformal transformations, it will include Poincaré transformations. Okay. So now what I want to do is, so these are vector fields. So you might have seen a little bit of this in your GR course, but essentially what this means is that I can write this this is what a vector field means. It's an object that parameterizes an infinitesimal transformation at any point in space-time. That's why you get this derivative. Derivatives are kind of small deformations away from the point in the tangent space. And if you compute the commutator of two conformal transformations, you get the point is that you get another conformal transformation, B3, where B3 is yet another conformal Killing vector whose components can be uniquely determined from the original two conformal transformations. So it has the form B1 nu, D nu. Checking this is elementary, just take derivatives essentially. So you can check yourself. Okay. So if I compute this commutator, I get another vector field with components given by that. And this guy, V3, is also a solution of the conformal Killing equation. So this fits our intuition that if I make one symmetry transformation and I follow it by another one, I get another symmetry transformation. And in formulas, this is what this means. I made two consecutive transformations and I get another transformation that now you can explicitly check that it's also a solution. Okay? So maybe the way to say this is that these conformal Killing vector fields generate an algebra. Maybe I shouldn't start this today, but let me just finish with that. Which is the algebra which has this commutation relation. So you're familiar with the SG2 algebra. So this will be some other algebra that we'll compute in next class. And this algebra is a conformal algebra. But this is something that we can compute from first principles by knowing that, by knowing essentially how conformal transformations act on coordinates. By taking these derivatives, we'll be able to identify the analog or the extension of the Poincaré algebra to the conformal algebra. You've seen the commutation relations of the Poincaré algebra? Yes? Okay. So what we'll see is that now, instead of having only these generators, we'll have these other ones. So we'll have fancier set of commutation relations will lead us to the conformal algebra. But maybe it's better if I start this next time. Any questions? Yes.
Relation bit again, right, going right back to that top right-hand board. So,
yeah.
So you're saying you mentioned to conserve charge associated to translations.
Yes.
Is that right? So, yes. But we think of conserved charge as an integral of the current.
Oh, right. This is a conserved current. So
this
is the current.
That's the current. Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Oh, yeah. So all these things I was talking about here were currents.
Mm-hmm.
So, but once you have the current, you get the conserved charge by, as I explained. So you have a conserved current. The conserved charge you can take by just taking the derivative along the spatial directions of the zeroth component. So why is this the conserved charge? Let's take the derivative with respect to P. So this gives you A0, J0, right? And now I use the conserved, the fact that the current is conserved. So let me spell it out more detail. This means that A0, J0 plus AI, JI equals 0. So now I use the fact that this guy equals minus this guy. So you have the integral of a total derivative. And if things behave nicely at infinity, which they usually do, this vanishes. So you have a conserved charge. Any other questions? Yes.
So how general is the statement that the conserved current comes from the stress energy
contraction? If it's a space time transformation, it's always true.
Always.
Of course. But of course, there are many transformations. So there are two types of transformations that we can have in physics. One, which is a space time transformation. Like this one, these are things that act on space time coordinates. But you can also have what are called internal symmetries that act on indices, internal indices like spin or some other global symmetry. And those are not space-time symmetries. So those are not written into the stress tensor. Only the space-time transformations can be written into the stress tensor because in the internal ones, you don't have in space-time, so Tim, you know. Any other questions? Okay, so tomorrow I'll write down for you the conformal algebra and study how fields transform under conformal transformations.